at the end of the previous session, preparation of our material. I would suggest that we get started on our preparation as far in advance as possible. At our church, we organise our teaching program 6 months in advance, so all the preachers have got 6 months in which to prepare. So we've got no excuse for not being properly read up and ready to go. Read as widely as possible. Don't think that I'm a sort of person who reads for leisure. Reading for me is work. I don't read for leisure. I wish I could. I'm a slow reader. But I read because it's part of equipping myself to do the work of God. It's no good in saying, I'm not a reader. It's not true. We are readers. People can read the TV Times, they can read advertisements, they can read all sorts of things. What most people mean when they say, I'm not a reader, is when it comes to reading, I'm lazy. That's what they're really saying. We are readers. We're all readers. And what we've got to do is to discipline ourselves to read the right sort of material and use our time as well as we can. So, as I say, I'm not the sort of person who just picks up books and reads them for fun. But I read them because I have to equip myself to do God's work. If I'm studying the Bible, I get myself into a place where you turn off the radio and put other things out of your mind and concentrate on what I'm doing. It's a case of sitting down and doing some work. Thoughts don't drift in through the windows from the air or from the birds or anything else. They only come as we concentrate on what we're doing and we study what we're looking at, sift and sort through the material. People have done it in doing assignments at school, college, university or whatever. We do the same thing when we're studying the Word of God. We go through the material and use as many resource facilities as are available to us. I also read if ever I'm on a bus or waiting for somebody or for an appointment. But I never go anywhere without something in my hand. That's where I get to read magazines and other things. Always carry a soft pencil in my pocket, also a piece of paper. I use a soft pencil because I don't like to disfigure books. A soft pencil, you can just bracket things, put little notes. You can make a note of anything that's worth filing away in a system on a loose piece of paper and then write it all up sometime later when you get home. The idea is to target those parts of the resource material that are going to be useful. You're going to find that in some commentaries and reference material, you wade through a lot of material to get a little bit of result. That's why my books have been designed for the busy person, and I've done most of that work. I've waded through the 75 pages of the introduction to such and such a book in the Bible, read through the 15 pages of the authenticity of the Greek text, discussed whether Paul was really Paul, and found out that he was after all. All this discussion that goes on in these technical works, which really chews up a lot of valuable time. And so that's why I've tried to shorten the process, and I'm encouraged no end at the number of preachers I meet from all sorts of denominations who are using my material as the preparation. Good, thanks. Boy, more of you. Who use that sort of material to help them in their preparation. I'm trying to help the ordinary person. We want to make shortcuts without throwing the baby out with the bathwater. In other words, the sorts of things that turn off so many people from serious study, the irrelevant material they read in reference books, I'm trying to get rid of that so that we can condense it down and get the maximum benefit from the amount of time available to us. Most of us are busy in all sorts of things. We don't want that to be an excuse for not doing the preparation work that is required of us. And when I've read these things and marked the parts that I think are useful, incidentally, I don't mark parts that have special little spiritual messages in them. I prefer to work up my own spiritual applications. The parts I mark are normally the things that are going to help me understand the text or the topic. And when you've gone through half a dozen pieces of material here over several weeks, I then sit down and I try to collect it together and then write down in my own words some of the things that I think are worth preserving. As I utilize material out of various books, I then erase the pencil marks. That means that I've used that material. It doesn't mean that I just copy it. In fact, I deliberately don't copy things. You evaluate them, and after a while you come back 2 weeks later and you think, why did I mark that? You might find it's not as useful as you originally thought it was, or you've come to disagree with what the person says anyway. But when we write it down, I'm very strict about this. Write it in our own words. 30 years ago, I used to copy things out. You'd collect copies of various bits and pieces, but I found after a while that that really isn't the best way to do things. Right from the very beginning, digest it, think it over, and then regurgitate it in your own words, so that right from the beginning we've got down our own material and not simply copied somebody else's. Simple communication. Practice saying things as simply as you can without using the jargon and preacher's words and expressions that we become very familiar with, or even the technical language that so often gums up the works when we're trying to preach and explain things. If we can't say a thing simply so that the uninitiated can understand it, then there's a very good chance we don't understand it ourselves. We ought to be able to communicate in language that anybody can understand. Now, as you're doing all this sort of thing, I'm not yet thinking of a sermon.
I'm simply getting the material. My sermon may only consist of 25% of the material that I assemble, but I'm getting it down in some sort of order, and as we move through, we'll find that certain divisions might appear. It's very difficult in this short time to go into any detail in all of this. Some other time we can talk about the nitty-gritty of how you actually prepare sermons and so forth. But just keep writing. I emphasize keep writing because it's the only way I find that I can really clarify my thoughts. We think we know a thing until we come to express it in concrete terms in black and white. And then we find we don't know it as well as we thought we did. It's the discipline of writing it down. I'm not talking about writing books. You know, this book here, the substance of that came out of studies that I gave in various countries, and I suppose my notes were around about 10 or 15 pages of A4. Now, the book was written out of that, but the notes are condensed out of that. And so all I do when I preach is just select the things that I think are worth saying. What I'm doing in these studies is very difficult if you're trying to take notes, because I'm rushing through. I'm not even giving you headings or anything to pin things on. That's all right. I've done that deliberately because all I'm trying to do is to get a few ideas across. We've got the book there, and all of it's there set out in much clearer fashion, so I don't need to bother about feeding people who are taking notes. But what I am saying is that when we preach, we must be mindful of the fact that the audience there is coming in dead cold, and we've got to orient them to what we're saying, and it's helpful if we can have our material in some sort of sectionalized form so that they can digest it as they go through. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sections, whatever we like. Those sorts of divisions and developments will become apparent as we're moving through. The way I like to preach is to be saturated with the topic, and then the notes that I actually take into the pulpit are just like that, just what I call memory joggers. So when we write it out, what we write out is the substance of our study. We don't write out the sermon, don't want to memorize sermons, and I certainly don't want to take into the pulpit 10 pages of notes, because I find that throws me. Some people find they can do it, but I can't do it. I like to be fluent, I like to be relaxed, have what I have in my head that I've already saturated myself with, and then just take some memory joggers into the pulpit, and every sermon that I preach can fit on one of those small pieces of paper. Little gimmicks you use, such as a bit of white paper here and there, indentations, underlines, use colours if you wish, something that your eye can pick up at a glance, just a word here, a word there, you can pick up the main ideas, but the substance of it is preserved. Sometimes I throw these things away, so that if I have to preach on the subject again, I can work it up from scratch from the basic material that I've got there. Incidentally, in these notes, I don't put down all my spiritual applications. I work those up every time I speak. What we do in the preparation of the material, and then in the preparation of the preaching notes out of the material, these are simply the main points, the substance, the truth, the ideas, the thrust of what we're going to speak about. In the case of going through a Bible book, I normally don't use notes. I just have things bracketed and notes made down the margin of the Bible or whatever that carries my eye from one part to the next. The actual spiritual applications that we make as we go along, I find it much healthier to just work those up each time I come to do a study in a book. If I've done that book 3 years previously, the substance of the book is not going to change. The truth, I hope, is more or less there. I might have a few fresh thoughts this way and that. But how we're going to apply that to the audience is going to vary from audience to audience, and it's going to keep us fresh so that we're not just regurgitating stale old sermon material, but we have preserved the substance of our studies. So see what I'm saying? Do some serious study, preserve it, get some files and spring ring folders and file it all away, get an alphabetical order, an order of Bible books, get some sort of index where we can make a note of the material we've used, listed under alphabetical order of authors, with the name of the book and the pages in the book from which you got the material, and you find that that will build and build and build. And over the years, you'll build yourself a reference system which will be extremely valuable. You'll have hundreds of titles, topics, book studies or whatever, and then whatever comes our way in terms of speaking to a youth group or a student group or a conference such as this, a subject is given to us, or we think we ought to speak on a certain subject, you'll find that you then have a whole index of reference material that you can put your finger on fairly quickly. In other words, make all our study work for us. File away our material. It will come in handy later on. Now, all the time we're evaluating, we're assessing, and make sure that we don't get stuck in thinking that all the knowledge I accumulated 3 years ago on this particular book or subject is set in concrete and can't change. As I say, we preserve it, but as I come back a few years later, I might have developed a few further insights. I might also have found that I had part of that around the wrong way the time before, but I've been enlightened a bit better in the meantime, and so I might have to change my notes. My books have been through several revisions. Each time you come for a reprinting, it gives you the opportunity to go back and straighten out a few things and make a few adjustments to suit the increased insights you might have had. So we're in a state of flux the whole time. We've never reached the state of final knowledge. We keep on learning, we keep on improving, we must be open to change, and yet at the same time maintain the substance there of the work that we have done. I'm quite surprised sometimes when I look up things that I wrote 20 or 30 years ago and find that I was more sensible then than I thought I was. And so the value of writing is not that we want to become writers. It's preservation of our study and it's clarification of our thought. And concentrate on getting rid of all that church language. I've worked very hard over the years to try to rid myself of most of the jargon that gums up so many sermons. Keep it concrete. The Bible very rarely uses abstract language. Now that comes as a bit of a shock when people hear it said, but it is true. The Bible is a very concrete book. The Jews were very concrete people. They thought in very concrete terms. Now when I'm talking about abstract and concrete, what I mean is something like this. If you say truth is a necessary attribute for the Christian character, that is really an abstract sort of a statement. Far better to say it in concrete terms, Christians should always tell the truth. You see what I mean? Say it nice and straightforward. Instead of all this theoretical or abstract reasoning about this concept or something else being a necessary attribute, just say, we should always tell the truth. Now, there is some language we must use biblical words, sin, for example. Salvation is another one. And we mustn't assume that people know what we mean or what the Bible means by those words. So we have to take time out to explain them. Once we've explained them, we may be able to use them further. Justification is something you can't really get out of. You've got to explain what justification means. God declares us righteous because of what Christ has done. Now, you may find other ways of expressing that, but there is a certain amount of biblical vocabulary that we're stuck with, and so what we have to do is explain it as simply as we can, and we still have to use some of those words, sin and salvation and faith and so on. But there are many words that we can mention once and then give an alternative, and we can stick to the alternative. For example, the word flesh that Paul uses in some of the traditional translations, talking of the old sinful human nature. Well, I think it's worth pointing out the word flesh, that's what it means. But having said that, I prefer then to use the expression sinful human nature because everybody understands what we're talking about, and try then to use that rather than the more theological word, which may not mean a lot to some people. So it's best, as I say, to make the connection, but try, in certain cases, to develop a style of speaking and a style of expression that if any person walks in off the street, uninitiated into the Christian jargon, they can still understand what we're talking about. And then, of course, there's just the old-fashioned preacher's jargon that we ought to throw out root and branch. There's so much stuff that really, you only ever hear it in churches. It's not just gospel halls, it's right across the board. In fact, I just come from Nigeria, where people speak English. It's an African English, but that's the main language in the country. And I heard somebody, a couple of times actually, thanking God for journeying mercies. Now, where do they get that? They obviously got that from some church-style people that came as missionaries. You don't hear ordinary people down the street talking about their journeying mercies. They might have talked about safety in their travel, and we might thank God for bringing us here safely, and we pray that he'll take us home safely. Everybody understands that. But when we use this special in-language, it immediately brands us as being something different, them and us. And so you've got these other people saying the Christians are really a sort of little club and they've got their own language and they're really a strange bunch. Render thanks. You don't render thanks to the person at the supermarket for doing something. We just thank him or her. There are so many expressions in our room instead. That you can go on and on. Now, I'm not going to start and rubbish all of this sort of thing. All I'm saying is just think. We've got to constantly think. This whole communications thing is at the root of our Christian problem in taking the gospel to people. Christians simply do not know, on the whole, do not know how to interact with non-Christian people. Many do not know how to communicate without resorting to the type of language that you only hear normally within the four walls of a church. We ought to be able to speak as they did in Bible times by using ordinary language. The language they used in the New Testament was the ordinary street language. It wasn't the highfalutin classical Greek, it was just the ordinary language that anybody spoke. And I should imagine that ordinary people off the street would have understood what Paul and these other people were saying. It was just the common language and they communicated in words that meant something in the local context. Just another thing about this concrete language and so on. when we come to the Bible, we've got to realize that even the theological concepts are given in concrete terms. For example, justification, as I mentioned. Justification comes from the court scene, the courtrooms, where the guilty was condemned and the righteous was acquitted. One person was declared guilty, the other was declared righteous. The whole notion behind justification, as developed in the book of Romans, comes from the courtroom scene. What I'm saying is, when we read the Bible, we have to understand it and teach it in a way that people are going to grasp and picture. Now, some preachers use illustrations quite a lot, but I think if we deal with the Bible the way it's given to us, we will need fewer illustrations than we might have imagined, because the Bible is written in pictorial language. Even the theology of Paul in Romans is saturated, almost verse by verse, with picture language. Unfortunately, we've got away from that and we've put it into doctrinal language, into abstract concepts, in keeping with our sort of Greco-Roman heritage or something. But that is not the way it was given. Adoption, he talks about. Again, you've got a picture that comes from life in those times when a person took somebody else into the family and that person then inherited the family name and property. You've got redemption. Redemption comes from the slave market, where you bought back somebody by the payment of a price. You've got justification. All expressions taken out of the common world in which people live. Now, when it comes to illustrations, we don't need to inject a whole lot of illustrations into our sermons in order to liven them up and make them interesting. If we deal with the Bible the way it was given, we'll find that our sermons are full of pictorial language, because that's the way the Bible is. Not only the New Testament, but the Old Testament, the prophets, the Psalms, almost every verse. Even talking about the attributes of God, if it's talking about the behavior of the people, they are all things that we can picture. And what we've got to do as preachers and teachers and leaders is learn to picture these things as the people in the Bible saw them, and then we've got to be able to recount this to the audience. So we don't have to jazz up our sermons and make them interesting by telling lots of interesting stories just to stop people from losing interest. If we deal with the Bible in the context in which it is given, then we're going to find that our sermons will be full of pictures. Now, just take Corinthians, which we looked at. It's very down to earth, isn't it? Very earthy. Paul talks in the opening chapter about this conflict and this faction fighting within the church. You can just imagine it. These characters down here all getting on side with their favourite and somebody else voting for somebody else and saying, we think he's the greatest thing. You can see this niggly thing developing in the church. He goes on then to talk about how when he preached in Corinth, he said, I was nothing flash, didn't seem to have the usual fluency, I was in weakness and fear, I was upset, I was thinking about other things, my speech was not anything that would have flattered the local debating society. But never mind, he said, we got a few converts and at least you trust in God. And you can just see Paul there talking about some very concrete things. And so it goes on. What are Apollos and I, anyway, what are we? He says, well, we're just servants, that's all. One plants, one waters, one reaps. God gives the increase. Again, a picture. All the way through, it's pictures, pictures, pictures. And what we've got to do is to learn to visualize that in our mind and not go off into this holy, spiritual, sermonizing type of abstract looking at things, but see these very down-to-earth illustrations. But most of the illustrations in the Bible are not illustrations of some long, drawn-out story that has everybody on the edge of their seats and wastes 5 or 7 minutes and then has one point at the end. They're not like that. There are some like that, admittedly. But most of them are analogies, as we just said with Paul. One sows, another reaps. Someone sows, someone waters. God gives the increase. It's an analogy which we can use. And our own illustrations, I think, are much more effective if they are of that type. One of the dangers with telling good stories is that the very fact that it is a good story means that it's probably not typical. The more spectacular the story, the less people are going to see it as relevant to themselves. If there are stories and if there are illustrations, we should keep them as broad-based as possible so that people cannot excuse themselves from the relevance. If I tell a very fancy story about some spectacular miracle, it may really sound great, and most people will tune out and say, well, that's okay for him or for somebody else, but I'm just an ordinary person. We've got to be careful we don't fall into a hole on this sort of thing. And another thing about illustrations and analogies, make sure that we know what we're talking about. Because it can be very embarrassing if we give an illustration out of an area of life that we don't know very much about. If I was speaking in some country area of Queensland and I gave some illustration or analogy to illustrate a point that I was getting across, I wouldn't refer to anything to do with farming. because you've only got to be one word out and immediately they'll all be sitting there saying, this fellow doesn't know anything about farming. So I steer off those things. I was at a conference in Tasmania once, and one chap was giving an illustration of something that had happened, some miraculous thing or some healing or whatever, and in the process of talking about how God had done this marvellous thing, he started to talk about the properties of blood in this baby that something had happened to, but he didn't realise that there was a pathologist also in the group. And the pathologist said, well, Kim, I don't deny your faith and it was great that God healed. He said, but all that you said about blood is simply a load of rubbish. It was a very delicate way of putting it, but he said, it's nonsense. And he said, what you've said is simply not true. And then he corrected that. That's the danger. I can be preaching and I can give an illustration and my whole 40 minutes of credibility can vanish if I've given an illustration as wonky in some area. And that just gives the person enough excuse to write off the rest that I'm saying. So we've got to be very careful. But I don't think we need all that many illustrations. I think if we handle the Bible properly, it's full of illustrations. The prophets are great. And then you've got all the narrative books, which are narratives. So that's very concrete. The laws of Moses are all very concrete laws about people that are arguing with their neighbours. Or an ox has just fallen down a well or something. All something that you can picture. We've got to develop the facility of imagining and picturing what we read in the Bible and then passing it on to others. Here's Malachi, and he's criticizing the people for the sorts of offerings that they bring along. And he says, this jolly animal you bring along here, you offer that to God. Got half its ears missing, its tail's all wonky, it's got one broken leg, hair's falling out all over it. Try offering that to the Persian governor. Would he be pleased with you? Here it is. Dear sir, your excellency, I bring along this animal and I present it to you as a birthday present. One leg's broken, but the other three are okay. The tail is a bit, you know, but never mind. Happy birthday, your excellency. He said, you wouldn't do that to the local governor, but we do it to God. We do, don't we? So often we do that same sort of thing to God. Now, that's what Malachi is saying. It just goes on and on. They're very earthy. These prophets were very earthy men. In fact, you've got to be very careful. Some of the things, the illustrations, we wouldn't get away with it, honestly. If I gave some of the rather close to the bone illustrations that some of these characters gave, I'd be looked on a bit cross-eyed. They were pretty feet on the ground characters. So what we've got to do is picture what they're talking about. Amos, he criticizes these people. He says, there you are, you're supposed to be ministers of the land, you're supposed to be ministers of the word, you're supposed to be leaders of the church, leaders of God's people, and yet you oppress the poor, sleep on beds of ivory, and he say paints the picture of this life of luxury. Never mind your stuff from Amart or something. This is a very fancy bed. They're all following around, drinking wine in bowls. Never mind your little sherry glasses and all that. These are bowls of the stuff, pouring it down. He said, you're not grieved. You're not grieved over the household of Israel. And here we are doing the same sort of thing. Living lives of luxury, we're lolling around the place, watching the box, munching crisps, chips or something. We've got a very self-indulgent lifestyle very often here in Australia, even among the church. And yet you can't stir people to get fired up over the destiny of people all around us that are dropping off into a hopeless eternity. He says, you're not grieved over the state of the place, and yet here you are, you can loll around. This is Amos getting stuck into the people of his time. And you can just see, you can picture what he's saying to them. And all we have to do then is get that across and update it and give a few updated parallels, such as us watching the TV or whatever it happens to be, to show how that human nature is remarkably consistent. I find this from language to language, from culture to culture, from country to country, from era to era. There is a remarkable consistency in human nature. So all we have to do is imagine the sorts of things that these fellows are talking about, and then be able to impart that to the audience so that they can see it. But what we're saying is not entertaining the audience, it's not telling them a story for the fun of it. What we're doing is actually expounding the word. We're taking what Malachi or Amos is saying, we're opening it up, and they can see it for themselves. And all the time we're talking, we're saying, you'll notice that in verse 3. I don't know if you picked it up last night, but all the time through, I'd say in chapter 18, if you look at verse 5, Paul says this. Look down like that. Look at this, and then you notice in verse 6 he says this, and everybody looks down like that. All very nice and responsive. When you say look at this, everybody looks at it. I just did a count just before I came down here. You know how many verses we actually read last night in our 42-minute talk? 49. We read 49 verses out of Acts and Corinthians. Now I've got a little bit of a rule of thumb. I hadn't worked that out in advance last night, and what I gave last night is not the sort of sermon that I'd normally preach in church, because this is a different sort of function, and so I prepared something a bit different. If I was doing that in church, I probably would have given some of the background from Acts, but not as much as I gave last night. I would have concentrated just on those first few chapters of Corinthians, and then I wouldn't have gone and given all the other details that I gave. But I just wanted to do that last night to give us the idea of how the two marry. But I have a theory that normally we can read the number of verses that's roughly equal to the number of minutes available to speak. So that if I've got a 40-minute sermon, I can really pretty well guarantee that we can get through about 40 verses. That doesn't mean to say it's a chapter of 40 verses. We might have a chapter or two chapters totaling 60 or 70 verses. But we can extract from that 60 or 70 the 40 that we're going to read. And the little bits in between we can just explain or pass over or give a summary and then highlight the next part on which we want to land. Now, as I say, last night I didn't know how many verses, but I thought I'd just check myself out, and so I went through it and we read 49 verses. Now, if you said we're going to speak on 49 verses, what most people would do is they'd read 49 verses and everybody would go to sleep in the first 7 minutes while we're reading those 49 verses. And they'd think about what they're going to do when the meeting's finished and whether the car's going to go tomorrow because the battery's flat. They all sort of tune out when we read large slabs of the Bible. So we don't read large slabs of the Bible. We go through large slabs of the Bible, but we don't read it all first and then start to talk about it. There are all sorts of tricks and ways of keeping people involved. I don't know if you picked up also last night that sometimes I commented on the verses before I read them. I gave you a bit of a summary of what the verses were, and then I said, let's read verses 1 to 3, which I'd already explained. And as we read through those verses 1 to 3, I was very pleased to find out that those verses actually said what I just explained they were going to say. So sometimes we can comment before we read. Other times we read and then make a comment afterwards. And so this just keeps a little bit of variety. We don't want to get stuck in a rut where everybody knows the routine. Read a verse, make a comment, read a verse, make a comment, read a verse, make a comment. And they tune out very quickly if they can see this very predictable pattern. So what I'm saying is, when we come to the exposition of the scriptures, we've got to use some imagination, we've got to be saturated with the text, and before we get up in the pulpit, we must know precisely the verses we're going to major on, the ones we're going to summarize in our own words, and the ones we're going to hit. And every time we hit those verses and read them, we say, now if you look at those verses, you'll find, and everybody does it. They just respond. As soon as you say we look at them, people automatically look at them. And so they're finding from the Word, they're finding from the Bible the things we want to say. Another little side benefit of that is that it keeps them active, so that they're not tempted to sit there and tune out and think of nothing for the next 15 minutes. Because every 2 or 3 minutes we're saying, if you look at verse 6, you'll find that that's exactly what Paul says. We'll do it. Oh, yes. Sort of wakes them up, just keeps them involved, so that people are involved in what we're doing. It is a monologue, because I'm just talking, one person talking, but everybody is getting involved by looking at the verses and seeing, oh yes, that's what the Bible says. But what is the message? The message is the Bible. All we're doing as preachers is drawing people's attention to what the Bible says. Read it in advance, read it afterwards, make the comment one way or the other, and then just drop in the application. Ask the question. I find it also quite useful at times to do what Paul did and what Malachi did in raising hypothetical arguments. Paul does it consistently. The book of Romans. He does it time and time again through the book. He presents a proposition and then he says, well now, what shall we say then? Does that mean that we can sin because salvation by grace alone? Not on your nelly, says Paul. Because if that's the way you think, then you've got it all wrong. Then he goes on a bit more. Well, what about Israel? Are they down the chute? Are they finished? No fear, says Paul. Look at me, he said, I'm an Israelite and I'm okay, I'm saved. What's wrong with the rest of them? Why can't they get saved too? You see, he looks at possible objections people are going to raise to what he's saying, and then he answers those objections. Malachi does the same as he goes through his book. He will say something to them, and then he'll anticipate their response. He'll accuse them of these worthless offerings that they bring. Ah, but you will say, how have we offended God? I'll tell you how you've offended God, says Malachi, and then he tells them. Oh, but you will say to me, where on earth is this? Well, I'll tell you where it is. He's anticipating objections, raising them, and that carries him on to his next point. And there's no doubt that if we can grasp the techniques that people like Paul and Malachi and others used, it's going to help to keep our exposition relevant and keep the people involved with what we're doing. so that we're not just standing up here and sounding like a talking commentary. That's what we don't want to do. We don't want to sound like a talking commentary that is just going through boring facts about this word and that word and this word and that word. Now let's move on to the next verse. And people very soon find it dry and dusty. Look at the way these people handle it. Look at Jesus, the way he would give his parables, his illustrations. He'd tell a story and then he'd ask them a question. Well, what do you think about this? And he very rarely ever gave a direct answer to a question that was put to him. He normally turned it back on them and said, well, I'll ask you a question. What do you think of this one? And then he would speak to them, get them to exercise their own brain and to think about the issues that he was raising. Well, so it goes on. I've completely got off my notes here. I'd bracketed them to try to pick out selections that I wanted to use because I was not going to get through all my material, but I've rather gone off the top of my head here with lots of other things. Oh, yes, I've got a note here about our headings and how, again, we keep our headings as pithy and as relevant and as up-to-date as we can. Try and keep off those stereotyped headings, subheadings, where we again use abstract terms. Religious pluralism, tolerating other views that might be different from our own. That's what it really means. The nature of coexistence. Well, it means getting on with people. So we speak in something that's meaningful and relevant and concrete. Now, if our subheadings happen to fit a pattern, well, fair enough. Peace, pardon, power, if they all come with P or D or X or whatever, well, that's all right. If it's natural, but please let us not force these sorts of headings. It's not important that people remember the subheadings of my sermon. It is important that they understand what the Bible says. And so what my exposition of the scriptures should be is something that enlightens people concerning the meaning of the Bible. I want them to understand the Bible, not to memorize my sermon outline. I'm not saying that I want them to forget what I've said, but they don't have to memorize what I've said. They only have to understand it. And if they understand what I've said in relation to the Bible, when they come to read the Bible for themselves later on, the things that I've said will come back. If I've locked in my comments with the text, the next time they read the text, some of the things I've said will come back, even if they've taken no notes and haven't remembered my sermon outline. So I keep coming back to this fundamental point. I don't want people to memorize my sermon outline. I want people to understand the Bible as I have expounded it. Because they'll always have the Bible with them, but they won't always have my sermon notes with them. But if we've done it the right way, when they come back to read that part of the Bible again, then some of the things that we said should come back and help them to further understand and develop their own work, whatever it might happen to be. Sometimes I will write out or memorize the opening or closing statement of a sermon. This is just a little wrinkle that we have. It depends on the style of talk. It hasn't happened in these talks I'm giving now because this is very much just as it comes, sort of informal type of thing. But it's very important sometimes to get a good clean start and to get a good clean finish, because you don't want to go round and round like an merry-go-round and then you don't know where to jump off. You have very much difficulty at times in bringing a thing to a conclusion. So I find it very helpful to write out or to memorize the opening statement so that we don't start off and say, and before you know where you are, you've made a complete hash of the opening. And memorize the closing statement so that we can finish it off neatly. And if there's something very dicey in the middle that we have to talk about, some issues that aren't easy to talk about sometimes, it's sometimes wise to write out what you want to say and memorize it so that you say precisely what you want to say, no more and no less. There are some very difficult things to talk about, as you'd be well aware. Which brings me to another topic, and that is that in our teaching of the scriptures in our churches, we ought to have some sort of Bible teaching program that allows us to go through the Bible, not consecutive from Genesis to Revelation that fashion, but a planned out program over several years where we have a balance each year, so that each year we're going to have a balance between the different parts of the Old Testament, the different parts of the New Testament, different areas of Christian doctrine and practice, so that we are feeding the church constantly over the whole area of the Christian revelation. And if we do that over 3, 4, or 5 years, then we'll cover every area of the Bible and Christian truth and practice. Now, one of the great advantages in this, besides feeding the church evenly and methodically, it enables us to talk about just about everything the Bible talks about. One of the difficulties with topical sermons is, if they find we're going to speak on a certain issue, people sometimes get a little bit alarmed. It may look as if we're having a shot at some particular person in the church, or it may be a topic that doesn't sound all that attractive. But if we're just going through the Bible book by book, virtually every topic sooner or later will come up, and it will be dealt with very naturally in the context of the book or subject we're dealing with. And so it won't be embarrassing, and it won't look as if we're firing shots at some particular individual, because we happen to have been doing studies, as everybody knows, through that particular part of the Bible, and this thing just happened to surface. It's a very convenient way of dealing with unpleasant subjects that have to be dealt with in our ministry. I think we just about have to leave it there. I've just got a note here about tell people the facts and let them feel the response. What I mean by that is, some preachers will want to tell you just how much we ought to be worshipping God, or how we ought to be this and we ought to be that. It's much better that we don't tell people how they should respond to anything, but simply give them the material in such a way that they will respond. Don't tell people how marvellous this particular event was at Burley. Just tell them how the event was and let them feel that it was marvellous. If we start telling them how great it was and using all these superlatives, it'll get their backs up. They'll think we're just trying to sell something. So we just tell them the facts, but then tell them in such a way that they will feel it was worth being there. And as we present the message about God or the gospel or the Bible, it's much better to have them enthused through their own response. Likewise, when we teach the Bible, we can tell people until we're blue in the face that they ought to read the Bible more. Whether they'll take any notice, I'm not sure. But if we handle the Bible in such a way that they get hooked on it, then they'll read it more of their own accord. You see what I'm saying? We don't tell them how to respond. We give them the material in such a way that they will respond in the way that we would like them to. And so we come back to the point again, that our emphasis is focused in the Word, in the text of the Scriptures that we are expounding. Well, I've got a lot of other things I'd like to say, but I think we'll call it a day. In the book, I've actually got working examples of how to expound a biblical book from the Old Testament history, how to expound an Old Testament prophet, how to expound from the Gospels, how to expound from one of Paul's letters. There are various working examples, how to teach the Bible to non-Christians. We haven't got onto any of those sorts of things. That's one reason why they're in the book, so that you can go through them at your leisure. Let's leave it at that, and we'll look at some questions later on, and if you have some questions from the floor that have arisen out of all the things I've talked about today, please say so. I want it to be a good open session as much as possible.